Welcome to State of the State, the monthly roundup of policy and research for the state of Michigan, brought to you by the Institute of Public Policy and Social Research at Michigan State and our friends here at WKAR Studios. I'm Arnold Weinfeld, Associate Director for the Institute. I'm joined, as always, by MSU economist Dr. Charlie Ballard and IPSR Director Dr. Matt Grossman. Later on, we'll be joined by our guest, Dr. Sarah Reckow, Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science at Michigan State University. Her research focuses on urban politics and policy and the role of nonprofits and philanthropy in the political process. Dr. Reckow will be discussing a recent report she co-authored regarding the impacts of nonprofits on governance in Detroit and Flint. But before that, let's talk a bit about the state of Michigan politics and economy. We finally have something of a state budget, or at least the legislature has gone home declaring half a state budget. Nationally, we have agreements now at all three major auto manufacturers. So, Charlie, as we end the year, how's the Michigan economy looking?
Well, the things that you just mentioned are good news, and I think they will help us head in the right direction. I would also mention the the new NAFTA, the USMCA, is finally going to be in place. That will help the Michigan economy. It will reduce the uncertainty, for one thing. Looks like we might have some relaxation of the tariffs with China. That would also help our economy. And frankly, we need some help because the economy of Michigan has been pretty flat. And it's not just Michigan. It's the upper Midwest. If you compare employment in October with employment in January of this year, we're down. Fewer people are working in Michigan in October. And the same is true in Indiana, Ohio, and Wisconsin. I think that has largely to do with the flat performance of the manufacturing sector. Now, some of that low employment numbers come from the GM strike, and when we get the November numbers, there will be some rebound for Michigan employment, but it'll probably be back to very close to no change for the entire year. Mm-hmm. So it's been a kind of a lackluster year, and I hope we can have some pushes to nudge the economy forward in the next few months.
So that's interesting because Vice President Pence was in the state last week and a half ago. He and the president are coming back next week, and I believe the vice president claimed that Michigan's jobs have grown by 70,000 since they've been in office.
That's right. About that number in the nearly three years, whereas in years like 2011, 12, 13, 14, we were gaining that many jobs per year. So we've had we were gaining an average of about 75,000 a year. Then in 2017 and 2018, it slowed down to about half that. And then this year, no job growth at all. So it is true that employment is up during the Trump administration, but much more slowly than in the previous years. Now, that's certainly not all President Trump's fault. It's probably partly his fault because of the trade wars. But this is sort of what you would expect if you're close to the top of a business cycle. There aren't that many workers out there who we could hire who have the skills that are necessary to do some kind of work. And so you expect to slow down. In fact, employment nationally has grown more slowly than, even though the latest job report was pretty good for the nation as a whole, national employment has grown more slowly this year than last.
Matt, we're coming into 2020, national election year. Any thoughts on how national or even state politics might play into the growth of the economy moving forward? Is there any correlation with, you know, an election cycle and how the economy performs?
Well, there is, but it has been a lackluster year in politics as well. We have graduated from stalemate in the state to agreement on the status quo. So we can chalk that up to progress these days, but really not a lot of policy change coming at the state level. At the national level, it is true that the performance of the economy is related to the success of the incumbent president, but that relationship is declining over time. Partially because people now see the economy differently in response to who's president. So Democrats are noticing the things going wrong, and Republicans are noticing the things going well, just like Vice President Pence during his visit. And so there's less of a potential effect when we're perceiving the economy through our partisan lenses.
So let's you mentioned state politics going from a stalemate to the status quo. So it's been a year in office for Governor Whitmer under Republican leadership in both the House and the Senate. Her big push from the campaign through her inauguration and in this first year was on the roads. And at the end of the day, that appears to have been put off into next year. First year assessment at all of Governor Whitmer and any accomplishments that she can point to?
Well, she does have an accomplishment with the auto insurance reform, but it's one that had more support from Republicans than Democrats. She didn't make any progress on funding for the roads. In fact, line item vetoed the funding that was made available on the short term by the Republican legislature. So it's hard to see really an impact from the move from unified Republican control to divided government, other than we see a whole lot more theatrics. That is, both sides have made a lot of noise, but in terms of actual policy change, we haven't seen much.
We're going to be able to gamble now in the state, apparently. That's a policy change, right?
So. That's right, and that actually fits with some trends nationwide. Several states have legalized sports betting alongside us, and several states have also moved to allow online gambling. So there are still nationwide policy trends ongoing, and the legislature still does pass things that we don't pay that much attention to that have more bipartisan support. But even by that measure, there's less legislation that's passed this term than for a long while.
So I think it's from stalemate to status quo. So really, in terms a policy,
sluggish, stagnant, stalemate, status quo.
Optimistic program we have here.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, what can we look? Let's try and be optimistic. What can we look ahead to as we close out 2019 and into 2020?
Well, I wouldn't give up on the roads yet. The fact that Republicans are not making a whole lot of hay yet on the road funding vetoes suggest to me that they are at least holding out the possibility that there'll be some kind of a deal in the new year, and that they might think it might look bad for them too if they don't make any progress on that. So, you know, there's always hope.
Now, I mentioned the trade improvement on the trade front, which is likely to help the Michigan economy. After all, we are much more heavily focused on international trade than most states because of our proximity to Canada. But at the federal level, there's one piece of legislation that I think is noteworthy because it will have, if passed, will have a big effect on a lot of Michiganders, and that is this bill passed by the House of Representatives to put some brakes on prescription drug costs. Now, President Trump at one time spoke very favorably about exactly that kind of policy. Lately, he's said that he's not in favor, but there is a companion bill in the Senate that doesn't go as far. Maybe we'll get something passed through the Congress, and it might provide some relief for prescription drug costs, especially for senior citizens. It won't be the kind of thoroughgoing reform that a lot of people were hoping for, or it's unlikely to be. The House bill is quite a strong bill, but it's received, as you might expect, considerable opposition from the pharmaceutical companies, and they are very, very powerful on Capitol Hill. So we're likely to get some incremental reform, which will probably provide incremental benefits for people who have high drug costs.
And prescription drug costs is one of those, or healthcare is one of those national issues that's also been, as you have noted, Matt, become a national issue that's become a state issue as well.
Right. The Democrats in the state legislature also had a package on prescription drug costs. It made it just as far as the bill in the House of Representatives. That is, I wouldn't necessarily hold my breath on major policy change there. The Democrats did agree with President Trump's proposal for a space force in the latest budget to the great delight of my six-year-old son. So maybe there is, you know, some progress on some fronts, if we want to call it that.
Very good.
Dun, 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 dun.
Well, we shall see what 2020 brings us as we end 2019. But now let's turn to the work of Dr. Echo. As I noted, Dr. Echo's research focuses on urban politics and policy. Along with her research work, she has led the Innovate Gov program here at Michigan State University, a program which affords students the opportunity to live and work in Detroit during the summer, earn credit, and work in nonprofits, city hall, and county offices. But a recent paper she co-authored examines the impact on local governance when nonprofits and foundations work to add capacity to financially strapped governments such as those in Detroit and Flint. Welcome, Dr. Echo, to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
So tell us about your work and what you found and your conclusions a bit.
Sure. So as you mentioned, I have a couple of co-authors, Josh Sapochny, who's also here at Michigan State, as well as Davia Downey, who's at Grand Valley State. And we looked at a couple of things. First, we looked at how the capacity of local governments, particularly focusing on Detroit and Flint, has changed over time compared to other Midwestern cities of similar size. And then we were interested, in light of those trends, which I'll discuss in a moment, what is going on with the nonprofit sector in these cities and whether nonprofits are doing some expansive and new types of work in response to government decline. So speaking to the issue of what's happened to the local public sector, both cities have experienced population decline. So it's important to note that from 2000 to 2016, Detroit's population declined by 29%. So you'd expect local government to get smaller if the city is getting smaller population. But city government employment declined by 51% during the same period of time. Flint's population from 2000 to 2016 declined 22%, but city government employment was cut by 56%. In both of these cities, this is much higher rates than what we observe for other Midwestern cities, which also saw reductions in city government employment, but on average about 17%. And if we look at specific areas of government, these are cuts not only to areas like parks and recreation and health, but also basic services like public safety were cut substantially during this time period. So what we explore then is whether nonprofits, rather than in the kind of traditional sense, you think of nonprofits as extending the work of the public sector, being a contractor for the public sector to do specific services, but instead in these cities are doing things that we traditionally think of as public sector responsibilities related to development and infrastructure and even paying for positions in the local governments in these cities.
And in particular, Detroit and Flint are fortunate to have two very large foundations that have assisted greatly along the way, Kresge Foundation in Detroit and the Mott Foundation in Flint. And as you noted, they have actually supported financially positions within both city governments along the way, given the fall off. Can you speak a bit to what this means in terms of who's actually running the cities then? Is it elected officials? Is it nonprofit-supported employees? And who answers to what?
Yeah, this is a great question. I mean, to give a couple specific examples from Flint, the person who was the project coordinator to replace the lead service lines wound up being paid with a contract with the Mott Foundation. When they hired a director of public health, which hadn't even been a function in city government, but in response to the water crisis was obviously a really huge need, also paid for by the Mott Foundation. But, you know, both of these cities were under emergency management. So it's important to acknowledge that the way democratic representativeness and accountability has been operating was already not what is typical at the local level. Both had a really reduced level of traditional representation. And then kind of into the vacuum both of capacity and responsiveness under that situation of emergency management, you had nonprofits stepping in, playing a much larger role. And now, as you know, in the post-emergency management situation, they're very close partners with city government in both cases. So I would say it's kind of a codependent relationship. The cities depend on the philanthropies and the nonprofits for financial support and for capacity assistance. And the nonprofits and philanthropy get more influence in large part because of this close partnership.
And what about what's the role of the state in this? You and your colleagues have done some work, some looking, some research at the state role over the course of time and how, you know, primarily through cuts in what we call revenue sharing to these cities, you know, has backed away from its responsibility to assist local units with providing services. So where does the state fit into all this?
Yes, the state's relationship to local government finance is extremely important in understanding at least part of how this has developed. There are certainly multiple factors involved, including the population loss and loss of economic activity. But state revenue sharing has been on a reduced level essentially since the early 2000s. And, you know, if you go back to 2001, 2002, that was the last time that state revenue sharing was at the level that, based on both constitutional and statutory rates, is sort of what the state is obligated to pay. And since that time, they have not, the statutory has been cut. And so therefore city governments and local governments in general are not getting what they would expect. And then what happens in cities that are losing population is that they're actually also losing their constitutional share because that is related to population. Add to that issues like Proposal A and Headley, and the ways in which property tax increases in the state are limited by state policy. And so basically local governments feel the full brunt of what happens when property values go into a downward spiral, as they have in Detroit and Flint, but are not able to capture the revenues when we have a recovery after those periods.
Yeah, I think some of your colleagues, Dr. Sapochny and I think Eric Scorsone have taken a look at the tax limitation provisions across the country and had a report a year or two ago that showed that Michigan has the second most restrictive local tax limitations in the country. So we have this reduction in state revenue sharing locally, a loss of population, a loss of capacity, an inability to try and raise funds locally because of these tax limitations, has led to a situation where you have the nonprofit sector working to kind of pick up the slack in capacity. So it's almost as a catch-22 at the local level, where they have no choice but to rely on a nonprofit sector, on a foundation sector. But again, still brings into question is who's running the place. Is it local elected officials? Is it the folks from the foundations and the nonprofit sector? And last but not least, is this sustainable?
That's an excellent question. And I think part of what drew us to this question and to exploring it the way we did is is that sustainability question that this seems to be a Band-Aid. And certainly in something, you know, we should put on the table here that the Flint water crisis is one very relevant event that took place and during the time period that we're looking at. A lot of the nonprofit and philanthropic activity in Flint is being responsive to the water crisis. And we expect nonprofits and philanthropy to step in when there's an emergency to provide aid. That's something that happens throughout the United States. So the question then becomes, then in the aftermath, how do you kind of return to a more routine process for funding public services and governing? And what we have not seen in Flint is a return to that. it's sort of continued in the governing mode that was part of the water crisis, where these organizations are still playing an outsized role. Mm-hmm.
If the state had not reneged on its revenue sharing commitments, millions and millions of dollars over this last two decades would have flowed into these cities that have not. Yeah. Would that have how much of a difference would that have made? Would the nonprofits still have felt the need to come in, or would they have looked at it and said, well, things are going okay, we don't need to do as much? I guess that's probably an impossible question to answer for sure, but do you have some sense of how big that is?
That's an interesting counterfactual. I mean, I think it would not have been – well – I think we should acknowledge again that Flint is a unique case here. With respect to Detroit, you could see ways in which the city government workforce would not have needed to be reduced as much as it was. And I would point to another thing here, which is one of the big things nonprofits have been doing in Detroit, which is essentially partnering on neighborhood infrastructure improvements of various kinds. I mean, Mayor Duggan has made a big initiative around fundraising from corporate and philanthropic sources on that. And so what we're ending up with is a situation where, yes, you should be able to fund basic repairs to your infrastructure on a regular basis and not have to defer those costs. It's like being a homeowner, right? And if you don't, replace your roof on a regular basis or do other kinds of maintenance, those costs get worse and worse and worse over time. And we're also seeing that with the Detroit Public Schools, where there's been an enormous, under emergency managers, enormous deferral of maintenance. And so the need to kind of raise extra capital to go in and deal with kind of basic things about streetscapes and the way sidewalks and lighting and things are put together would probably not have reached the crisis levels it did if you were in a position to keep up your regular maintenance of your infrastructure. That being said, there's still basic structural issues when you have population decline on this scale. These are cities that were built for populations, at least twice as large as the population that currently resides there.
And case of Detroit, almost three times.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not as if that, that problem is, it's been magnified by the fact that the state is not coming through on the revenue sharing.
Any thoughts as to what the outlook might be for cities like Detroit and Flint and others across the state of Michigan when the next economic downturn really comes into play? Are these communities in a position to sustain themselves over the course of time?
I would be very concerned about that, especially because property taxes remain an important source of revenue for local governments. Although, it's important to note that there have been, different ways they've diversified their revenue. Detroit has the unique ability to raise taxes from casinos that are in the city, and that has played an important role. I mean, it would have been much worse in the absence of that new revenue. But they're, these are cities that are taxing at a high rate on a very low taxable value. So their residents are facing a high burden and property values are still low. And were those property values to go into another downward spiral. It's not a good situation. It speaks to broader issues about how we finance local government in Michigan, about how we have, had population become more spread out in metropolitan areas and yet continue to have the long-term costs of infrastructure in our urban cores for the population that used to reside in those places.
And we have,
Has it been fortuitous to have these foundations? I mean, we got two very major cities that just happen to have very top-tier philanthropies. Mm-hmm. We have some other cities like Lansing and Saginaw that do not. Uh-huh. If the foundations, if they just want to show up at the ribbon cutting with the mayor, maybe it's not a huge net loss. What are the costs of this kind of a system to have the philanthropies willing to step in?
Yeah, no, this is a really good question because it's you can understand why in the short term the relationship continues the way it does. The philanthropies, whether it's Mott or Kresge and others in Detroit, or you could look at Battle Creek with Kellogg as another good example, they're being responsive to needs. There are, though, I think if I could put one thing on the table of maybe a more questionable decision that resulted from a lot of philanthropic influence, we could talk about the Q Line in Detroit. So Detroit has, been a city that doesn't have a great deal of investment in public transportation. People who are dependent on public transportation primarily use the bus system. And during the time that Detroit was going into bankruptcy, some philanthropic and business leaders, so this would, speaking of specifics, Kresge, but also Dan Gilbert and others were involved in some planning for a light rail line. And wound up creating M1 Rail, which is a nonprofit. The board of M1 Rail does not have a public sector representation. And actually the single largest funder of that project, which became known as the Q Line, because Quicken purchased the naming rights, is Kresge. It's not the U.S. Department of Transportation. It's not the state of Michigan. It's not the city of Detroit. So we had a transit system built with primarily non-governmental interests influencing it. And truth be told, it's a neat project, except it's not a particularly useful addition to the public transportation infrastructure of the city of Detroit. It's nice if you want to take a short ride and get to a Tigers game, but the vast majority of the population in Detroit does not have access to the Q Line. It's not, in great ways supplementing people's ability to get to work. And so if you think of that as a kind of an opportunity cost situation, like what could you have done with similar resources to truly address the transportation needs of the citizens in a way that maybe had the process been more of a traditional public involved process, you might have come up with something different. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think you probably would.
Well, thank you for your work on this. It's going to continue to be an issue, especially as we move into a downturn in the economy. And we will move into a downturn, a slowing of the economy, if we haven't already. As to how sustainable some of these communities are. You mentioned, Battle Creek, but Matt mentioned Saginaw, and there are a host of other what I call mid-major cities. We haven't even touched on the legacy cost issue that these cities face as well. You layer that on top of it, and 2020 is going to be an interesting year to see how we are able to move all this forward here in the state of Michigan and across the country. Matt, Charlie, any final thoughts?
Happy holidays and a happy new year. I guess the next time we do one of these, it'll be 2020.
It will be 2020.
It'll be a new decade.
Yeah. And
I just say one thing that has enabled the legislature to not do a whole lot this year is that there haven't been many crises on their plate. But you get another recession, The Flint and Detroit public schools will both need support. You will have new things coming that get put out on the plate that the legislature didn't put them there. Yeah. So they haven't used their open time all that well. And sometimes events change what you have to discuss.
Right. And as we noted, 2020 will be a big election year as well. Well, Dr. Reckel, thank you again for you coming on the show and talking about this very important work. And that's all the time we have for this edition of State of the State. My thanks again to Russ White and the staff here at WKER for their support of this program. And as been noted, you'll hear from us next year on State of the State.